All right. He said, they said, he not only is a Samaritan, but thou hast a demon. See, he called them, their father was the devil. Now they're saying back, you're a Samaritan, you got a demon. That's quite a name calling here. This is quite a confrontation. Now remember, Jesus was in this confrontation. And if you read this carefully, I repeat again, he didn't take it sitting down. Well, he went after him on that particular occasion. Now let's continue and see what he has to say.
He spoke about the leadership right here. Must have known something about his birth in order to be popping these charges up. I mean, as far as his parentage coming from Joseph.
All right,
while they must have known that Joseph raised him, they must have known something about the idea that Mary was with child before Joseph had married her.
Do you suppose when the thing got very intense that they didn't have an investigation?
You bet. There's something right here.
All right, the thing is, they weren't above investigating, and so they had it. In other words, they could throw it down to him so that, in other words, and the people, you see, this is one way, break the hold, slander, anything you can to tear something up.
Well, they must have thought that Jesus' father was a Samaritan. See, they lived in Galilee.
No, not that. No, the point is simply this. A Samaritan was a very bad name. In other words, for example, let me see what was happened there. During World War I, if the German Americans were not in favor of the Kaiser, they were called a certain thing. Let me see. The Germans had a name for those that they felt ought to be behind, the German Americans ought to be behind the Kaiser. They said that way, and they really went to did some smearing. I can't think of what they called my dad. They had a name for him. In fact, they actually took yellow paint and painted my front of my dad's door yellow at night because it didn't go along with the German issue in the terms of World War I. So you see, this is what they were doing. Samaritan is a bad word. If you wanted to down somebody, well, I think, and I say this without anything in any reference there, but there's also such a thing as calling a black person a nigger. All right, this is the same thing that was involved here in the matter. He's a Samaritan.
They were considered dogs.
Dogs, right. In other words,
the Samaritan woman.
What?
The Samaritan woman.
Big pardon?
The Samaritan woman.
Well, that's a different situation as you went there with the well. But what I'm saying is, this was the name that they did some name calling as far as the picture was concerned.
In other words, even if the person was really a Jew, they'd call him a Samaritan.
That's right, that's right, that's right.
In the South, we have an expression that somebody's so bad I wouldn't even spit on them.
Okay. Okay.
You, that's pretty bad.
Aren't you? See, certain things, I don't know what you got over in Australia, you may have something even over there is bad or worse.
So this name would have been thrown out, not with the idea that the illegitimate father
was not connected. That wasn't, there was no connection there, right.
Okay. How do we know there's no connection there?
How do we know?
Yeah, I mean,
well, Samaritan and Galilee are two different entities.
Well, I know that, yeah, but could they possibly have thought that his father was that literally, though?
Well, what they would—the only way they could
assume. The only discrepancy I'd see there is when he was dedicated at the temple. They went ahead with the dedication there.
Right. The only thing that they could possibly assume is that Mary stepped out with a Samaritan.
You're right. That's what I'm saying.
All right, but that is not in this picture.
Okay.
All right. Let's go on down a little further. Start with how Jesus responded. Verse 55. Well, let's read the context. 53rd verse. They say to him. Well, back up to the 52nd verse. The Jews said unto him, now we know that thou hast a demon. Abraham died in the prophets, and thou sayest, if a man keep my word, he shall never taste death. Art thou greater than our father Abraham, who died, and the prophets died? Whom makest thou thyself? Jesus answered, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father that glorifieth me, of whom ye say that he is your God. And ye have not known him, but I know him. And if I say I know him not, I would be like you, a liar. Now, this is the language of Jesus in responding. And then we think we have to be so soft in dealing with this kind of stuff? Yeah, let's get over our softness. And let's really speak it out.
Let's make sure we have his spirit on it.
Well, you think, all right, you think that he was lovingly saying to them, ah, no, you're a liar.
I said his spirit. I didn't say anything about his tone of voice.
Okay, granted, we need to have his spirit, and his spirit is the spirit of truth.
And we'll also notice that this was a confrontation of leadership, not with the sheep.
All right, granted, I grant you that's an important point.
Yeah, it is.
We need to make that differentiation. And so forth, but we need to speak out when it comes to that point. I appreciate getting that up, but I think we need also not to tone it down too far.
Oh, I agree. It doesn't negate speaking up and telling the truth, but it does negate my person getting involved.
Right.
He was doing this to glorify his Father.
Right. Well, we need to speak forthrightly.
Absolutely.
And you're not amiss on that.
Thank you.
All right. She's not going to mind that. I know her. She knows me too. So, I mean, it's... Okay, now let's come on down on this particular point. Reading on further. And let's see, where are we? We're about a liar here somewhere. What verse was it?
55.
What's that?
56.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'd be like you, a liar. But I know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. The Jews therefore said unto him, Thou art not yet 50 years old, and hast thou seen Abraham? And Jesus said unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was born, I am.
That expression got him in trouble.
What's that?
That expression really got him in trouble.
That's right. He had been saying it before, but now he comes down emphatically in the context of time. And they took up stones therefore to cast at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. Now, here's the thing where we need to pause. It says he hid himself. Now, if you'll notice that the margin gives you that many ancient authorities add that going through the midst of them went his way and so passed by. The verb in this instance that's translated hid himself is a second aorist passive. Now, what's a passive? Now, it says here, he hid himself. That's active.
Right.
See, they translated it active, but it's the verb is passive.
Acted upon.
Who hid him? Here they were, ready to take up stones. His hour had not yet come. He was able to pass by unseen. He was hid. Again, a wonderful promise of hope. If we're in line with him who has a plan for our life and danger threatens from any source, what will God do? He'll put his hand over and pass by.
We've got to remember that I think our experience would be more like the experience of Paul rather than the experience of Jesus. Paul, although he was protected and he was kept alive, he was attacked, beaten, thrown in the garbage heap. So I think we probably will endure. I'm talking about the last end of time. We will probably endure a physical persecution of Jesus.
All right. Now, may I counter on that a moment?
Sure.
All right. Granted what you say about Paul. Granted what you say about Christ now. But didn't he ultimately suffer? Wasn't he? That's the ultimately. What I'm saying is, it was not yet his time. All right, in the plan of God, it was not yet time for him to suffer. Therefore, what? All right, if it's not in God's plan that I suffer at this moment, what will he do? If it's in the plan of God that I suffer, that my character might be perfected further by his working, what will he do? I'll go through. It's constantly, and in each of these experiences, we can rest in the fact and the confidence that God has control. And he will not suffer us to be tempted or to be persecuted above that which we can bear.
Of course, their ultimate plan was to kill him.
Right.
They didn't plan to just make him suffer. And so his time had not come for that either.
Right, because he had certain prophecies of suffering. Right.
Well, he had to be brought as a lamb without spot and blemish, too. So when he was taken, he wasn't already all beat up and mangled up.
He was without, that's right, you got a point there, without spot.
You know, he had to be without spot and blemish, you know, when that whole process began to fulfill prophecy.
All right, now we're down here at the end of the eighth chapter, and this will be a good point for us to take a break. And we'll come back beginning with the 9th chapter, and we'll try to do some highlights as we continue on through, because we'll just have, and we're going to make the break short. 10 minutes. This 9th chapter of the Gospel of John, if you want more detail than is possible for us to give in this brief summary as we're moving through the other part of the book, you can get the tape, Laodiceanism Illustrated, which is based on this particular chapter. Laodiceanism Illustrated. What's interesting is this man that was born blind. The real question, and though it is not specifically answered in this chapter, is inferred. And that is, what condition was this blind man in as far as eyes were concerned? And how was his eyesight restored? What did Jesus do? He took clay. Well, he made it, all right. How was man made in the beginning? Then he was acting, he was demonstrating his creative power. All things were made by him, and without him was anything that was made. The restoration, as the picture gives it here in this chapter, was so complete that he didn't look like he looked previously, and some didn't recognize him. The inference is that he was born without eyeballs. And Christ created them, or caused them to come into existence so that he could see. Now, of course, the interpretation would be, who sinned? This man or his parents? No, Jesus said that is not the reason for this situation. But for what reason? That the work of God should be made manifest in him. How would you like to be blind for a number of years of your life without the possibility of ever seeing? And not know why. He didn't know why. But God had a purpose. Without dealing with the concept of predestination, which has been, through Calvinism, various things have been put in a wrong light, God does control destinies. What about Jeremiah? I knew thee when? When you were the fetus. I chose you. Why could he? How could he? What could he know? You see, the foreknowledge or the knowledge that God has to be balanced off with his plans and purposes. Why could he say, Jeremiah, I knew you in the womb? Does he not know anything about genetics? Who knows the most about genetics? The one who's a professor of genetics or God? He knew what kind of man Jeremiah was going to be and would be as a result of his what? There you are. Now you have here a man born blind, lacking eyes to see. Jesus comes and says, now this is for the glory of God, and God gives him not only his natural sight restored, but much more, his redemption. You see again, if we're willing to be a part of God's plan and purpose, what wonderful promises and hopes the Scriptures have for what he will do for us. The sad part of it about it is that while we're living this life, we too often forget to let God just take control. And you know, if you're going to be honest with yourself, and I have to be, all the major mistakes in life that I have made, besides all the minor ones, has been because I have not moved and listened to God's direction at the point of the time when I made a decision. And I don't think there's anyone in this room that can deny that they don't have the same element. But now let's notice what develops. He's emphasizing that he's the light of the world. And as the light of the world, he came to give light. And so he anoints the eyes of this blind man. He goes to the pool called Siloam, which is sent. He's sent. Even as Jesus was sent the light of the world, now he sends this man to the pool to receive light. And he washes and comes seeing. The neighbors, therefore, when they saw him, this is the 8th verse, aforetime he said that he was a beggar, this and so forth. Is not this he that sat and begged? He had no other way of making a livelihood. Others says, it is he. Others said, no, but he's like him. He said, I am he. They said, therefore, how then were thine eyes opened? He answered, the man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said unto me, go to Siloam and wash. And I went away and washed, and I received sight. And they said unto him, where is he? He says, I know not. Now, he knew who did it. But they don't dare to make a decision. They don't dare to accept an accomplished fact. So where do they go? They got to go to their religious leaders in order to be on the right side and make the right confirmation of this thing. They can't make it themselves. So they bring him to the Pharisees. And it happens to be what day of the week? Again, Jesus chooses to perform one of his greatest miracles on the Sabbath. Why does he have to bring this issue into it every time? See, every one of these miracles that we've noted here that has caused trouble with him and the leadership have been done on what day?
The Sabbath.
The Sabbath. The confrontation is over the Sabbath. And I don't think they brought him on the Sabbath day of the Pharisees. It was on the Sabbath day that the clay was made. That's what it says here. Now it was the Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Again, therefore, the Pharisees said unto him that received his sight, how is it that you got it? And he put clay upon my eyes, and I washed it, and I see. Some, therefore, the Pharisees said, this man is not for God because he didn't keep the Sabbath. Well, this says, well, how can a man that is a sinner do such signs? And now where's the division? Not between the rulers and the multitude, but now the Pharisees are starting to have problems among themselves. The division now is there. And they can't agree on whether we should keep the Sabbath or whether this is a marvelous miracle that we need to recognize. They say, therefore, unto the blind man, what sayest thou of him, in that he opened thine eyes? Well, he's a prophet. The Jews, therefore, did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and had received his sight, so they called the parents. They thought this was something that had been pushed over and worked out in such a way. So they asked him, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered and said, we know that this is our son, and he is born blind. But how he now seeth, we know not. But who opened his eyes, we know not. Ask him, he's of age, he shall speak for himself. Don't bother us, we're out of the picture.
We don't want to be bothered.
No, that's not the point. It says, these things said his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man should confess him to be Christ, he would be excommunicated. So the best thing to do is keep your mouth shut, even if it's your own child, rather than be excommunicated. See? Just quiet it down. He's of age. Ask him. He's our son. He was born blind, but we don't anymore. Couldn't they believe their own son when he said who, what happened?
They probably did.
Did they do such a bad job of raising him that he was a liar?
No, they were.
What's that?
They were.
They
didn't know who did it.
All right, right. They were willing to cast reflection back on themselves and reveal their own spirits than to be honest with the facts. Now, so they decided to ask him again now, because that's where the direction was. Therefore said his parents, he's of age, ask him. So they called a second time the man who was blind and said to him, give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. Christ a sinner? We know it. Why? Well, he healed you on the Sabbath. He therefore answered, what is a sinner? I know not, but one thing I know, that where I was blind, now I see. They said therefore to him, what did he to thee? How opened he thine eyes? He answered them, I told you. And ye did not hear? Wherefore would ye hear it again? Would ye also become his disciples? And boy, then the thunder, boy, was ready to pull everything out. He just really upset the whole group. And they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are the disciples of Moses. Why do you even act this way toward us? Haughty, haughty, haughty. We know that God has spoken unto Moses, but as for this man, we know not whence he is. The liars again. This time the clergy. The man answered and said to them, why? Herein is a marvelous thing, that ye know not whence it is, and yet he opened mine eyes. We know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God to do his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, it was never heard that any man opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not of God, he could do nothing. That's a pretty good sermon in a nutshell. They answered and said to him, thou wast also altogether born in sins, and you teach us? And they cast him out. Now there's excommunication by clerical decree. The whole picture. This is Laodicea. Laodicea cast you out if you confess the truth. Excommunicate you. Jesus heard. And this is always an interesting thing. How did he get this information so quickly? I don't know. But he heard. He had his own contacts. Anyway, Jesus heard that they'd cast him out. The word of the excommunication got around, or however Jesus had means. And so Jesus looked him up. Jesus sought him, and he found him. Now notice, to anyone who is excommunicated for truth's sake, Jesus the truth finds him. Think it over. Jesus finds him. And he found this man. He said, do you believe in the Son of God? He answered and said, and who is he, Lord, that I may believe on him? And Jesus said to him, thou hast both seen him, and he it is that speaketh with thee. And he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Worshipped him. God in the flesh, the Son of Man, the Creator. He realized the fullness of true Sabbath observance, the worship of a Creator. Had not he had creation done on him?
John is careful to add that point here too.
And Jesus said, for judgment came I into this world, that they that see not may see, and that they that see may become blind. Now catch that point and don't miss it. For judgment came I into this world, that they that see not may see, that they that see not may see, and that they that see may become blind. Then those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said unto him, Are we also blind? Jesus said to them, If ye were blind, ye would have no sin. But now ye say we see, and your sin remaineth. The Laodicean says, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. And yet he's blind. He says he sees, and therefore his sin remaineth. And this is the tragedy of the church. Their sin remaineth. Because they claim they see, and they see not. Blindness has come upon them. God forbid that we fail to see light when it shines upon our pathway. The greatest thing that can happen to any of us is to fail to walk in the light as he is in the light. The light from the throne. For if we will walk in the light as he is in the light, we have what?
Fellowship.
Then the breakdown of fellowship is over what? The failure to walk in the light nullifies fellowship. If we walk in the light as he is the light, we have fellowship. For we're in the same light. And furthermore, the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin. Yes, I am the light of the world. He came that man might have light. And if you have not light and want it, he will even create the agencies and the means by which you may obtain that light. Wondrous provision. Wondrous provision. Now we come to the 10th chapter. Yes? Speak loud enough.
I was given a free ticket to go to a Youth of Christ fundraiser.
Yes.
And
you say you were given an invitation to go, or given a what?
A free ticket.
Oh, a free ticket to go. Okay.
And this chapter was used by the, I call him entertainer. He was a professional musician that quit music and went on now to work for Youth of Christ. And he put this whole chapter in a comedy scene. And he laughed and laughed and laughed about the comments he made. Now, I look back at that now. I walked out of there troubled. I was hurt. I was impressed to get up and leave, but I didn't have the guts to do it. I'm being honest. If I had been there again, I would have walked out. Because it didn't get me.
In other words, it was doing away with the whole force. All right, coming down to the 10th chapter. We need to know just a few things here about what Christ had to say. He says, I say unto you that he that entereth not by the door into the fold of the sheep, and climbeth up some other way, the same as a thief and the robber. All right, who's the door?
Yes.
All right, if you do not go through with him, then you are in what category?
Thief and a robber.
So it is important that if you're going to be a shepherd, you're in line with whom? The good shepherd, and go in the right door. Now it says the shepherd leadeth them out. That's different than we sometimes take things today. It's driving, but he leads, and he leads by what? How does the shepherd lead back there?
Calling sheep by their own name.
What?
By calling them by name.
By his voice.
His voice, yeah.
His voice, calling him by name. His voice. He leads by his voice. They follow his words. He leads us in the same way. But we've got to be willing to follow his words if we're going to be the sheep in the proper, I mean, the proper fold. Now, there is a distinction here made between the flock. It says there in the ninth verse, he says, "And other sheep have I which are not of this fold. Them also I must bring, that they may hear my voice, and they become one flock and one shepherd." Different folds, and he's going to bring them into one fold, and there's going to be one flock and one shepherd. Now, this, of course, is perverted by Catholicism and the Mormons, verse 1, but we need to also recognize that God's intent is what? One fold, or one flock, and one shepherd. This disunity is really, we probably don't sense it as much as God senses it. He prays that we might be one, and we're so far from oneness today that it's pitiful. Because we're not walking in the light, and we're not willing to walk in all the light that God gives us. This is a problem. Then we have a confrontation again between Christ and at the Feast of Dedication at Jerusalem, about the fact that he and his Father are one, and accused him again of blasphemy. And Jesus left and goes across the Jordan. Now when you come to the 11th chapter of John, you come to the story of the greatest miracle of his entire ministry, raising Lazarus to death at a time when there was absolutely no way that they could say that something had happened. He had been dead 4 days. I'm going to mention a little bit about this tonight, and so I'm not going to go into detail over it, except to point out certain key points. Why did Jesus weep? There he came to the tomb where Lazarus is buried, and he wept. Why? The people caused him to weep. It was not a matter for Lazarus. He didn't weep over Lazarus. But what was he going to do? Call him forth. And why should he weep over Lazarus? It was the unbelief of the people. Their hardness of heart. For he knew that standing right there in that group that had come out and professed such a warmth and such sorrow, such feeling for those two sisters. Some were standing there that would make the trail between Bethany and Jerusalem hot with dust to get to the Pharisees and the rulers with what happened. In each of these crowds, he sensed those that were against him, and they were there not for a purpose to learn, but to take a story, slant something, work something against him. He wept. Now, he also tells, or Martha says something to him, I think, let me see, is it Martha or Mary? Let me see here.
Martha says it, verse 5.
Verse 5, that's what, all right, that's loved, I mean, something that verse, where for? Let's see.
21, Martha said, if you could be here.
All right, that's not one I want. Which verse is it?
21.
All right, 21. We're down 21 then. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went out to meet him. But Mary still sat in the house. Martha, therefore, said to Jesus, "Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." Now again, the picture's here, constantly through John. Did Jesus know that if he got back immediately as soon as he got the word that Lazarus could have been restored in life? He would not have died, right? Jesus stayed where he was long enough that the disciples forgot about it. Why? Did he not know the sorrow that would come to those two women's hearts? Did he purposefully have that come? Right.
He saw beyond the sorrow.
All right, did they, would they, well, did they understand the part they were playing?
No, not the time.
They were sorrowing. Sometimes we do not understand the present because God has something in the immediate future. Are we willing to bow in the present so that the future might be realized? Wouldn't they have preferred Jesus to get back there quick? He made them wait. They knew that if Jesus had been there, his brother would not die. Now, Jesus gives an assurance there. Jesus said to her, "Thy brother shall rise again." Ah, she caught only one part. "I know that he shall rise in the resurrection at that day." Here's a sister, an older sister, making this comment about her brother. He must have been a pretty good man. "I know he'll come up in the first resurrection." You know, it's a wonderful assurance to know that fact.
Why does she make the statement then in verse 22? You know, after she says the statement of, if he had been there, that she knew that Lazarus would have died. Why does she say, "But I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it thee."
True. But she still didn't have the faith to grasp it. When he told her, he says, "Thy brother shall rise again." Where did she put it? It was a faith, theoretical. She hadn't grasped the full intent of the thing, what it could be. Now, what did Jesus say to her? "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on thee, though he die, yet shall he live. Believest thou this? Yea, Lord, I have believed that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, even though he come in the world." And when she had said this, she went away and called Mary. She confessed her faith, but she still didn't grasp what could be. And so then Mary was told secretly, "The teacher is here and calleth for thee," and she rose quickly and so forth. And the Jews follow her out, and then they take the tomb. And so the Jews interpret his weeping. See how he loved him, but he was weeping for them. Now he tells them at the tomb, "Take away the stone." Jesus will not do what man can do. Right? There was another stone that needed to be rolled away. Not many weeks hence. Who rolled that stone away?
An angel.
Why?
Because there was no man there to roll away.
If there were a man, would you mean to tell me the disciples were not strong enough to roll that stone away?
They were shut up.
Yeah, there was a Roman guard there.
What?
There was a Roman guard there to keep men away.
The tomb was sealed and a Roman guard was there protecting it.
Roman guards, not one, but one.
All right, guards were there. All right, there was no way for a man to do it, right? Who did it? God will do what man cannot do, even to the extent of interfering what man has tried to prevent being done. But here the stone was there, and so he says, "Roll away the stone." Now furthermore, to show how God works, all that he said was, "Lazarus, come forth." And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. And Jesus said to them, "Loose him and let him go." Jesus didn't do it.
I might mention, if someone was made by Martha,
yes?
They were believing that Jesus could resurrect him. You might just look at verse 39. When he said, "Take away the stone," Martha immediately said, "Don't do it. He smells already." She really had no confidence that Jesus...
She hadn't exercised faith. It was just merely a theoretical thing with her. All right. Jesus works. But also, that which you can do, you're expected to do. Now, immediately, a council got together. And this man is doing too much. We're in trouble. If we let him thus alone, all men, there's on verse 48, will believe on him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, ye know nothing at all, nor do ye take account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not. What a perception that was so deceptive. A perception of what the purpose of God was, and yet said in such a deceptive manner. And by such a spiritual leader. Tragic. Now this he said not of himself, John commenting now, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation. A Caiaphas prophesied? Or was he forced to say certain things that turned to be a prophecy and God used them? And so from that day forward, they took counsel that they might put him to death. So Jesus walked no more among the Jews, but departed thence into the country near the wilderness into a city called Ephraim, and there he tarried. And then it goes, the the Passover comes, and the chief priest and the rulers give a commandment, Pharisees, that if any man knew where he was, he should show it, that they might take him. Coming now to the 12th chapter. And as you note, I'm touching certain highlights as we go on through here. True. Well, this was an outstanding miracle that attested to his divinity, but it also was a thing that really stirred up the leadership also on them. It reacted both ways. Now, notice it says that in their plans and their laying of their plots, that the common people, therefore the Jews, learned that he was there. And let me see. This is a certain Pete. This is now he's come back to Bethany, and you have the anointing. And then the common people, therefore, verse 9 of the Jews, learned that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. He's a living testimony to the power of the Christ, of the resurrection of life. Now what do they do after this because of the people coming out to see Lazarus? The chief priest took counsel that they might put Lazarus also to death. They not only put Christ to death, but they want to put about every bit of evidence that was there testing to his divinity and power. This was the religious leadership of Israel.
Well, of course you're going to destroy all the evidence.
Right? But notice again, religious leadership. Don't miss that fact. All right, coming on down further in this story, he plans for the Passover. I'm not going to go into the details of the possibilities of which days of the week is involved here, because if you count backward on some of these things that are given a little later on and in the other Gospels, it may be that the Palm Sunday was not exactly Sunday, it could have been Monday. But we won't go into that kind of a detail at this moment. The fact is that... Well, let's just read, starting with the 12th verse. On the morrow, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took the branches of the palm trees and went forth to meet him and cried out, Hosanna! Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel. And Jesus, having found a young ass, sat thereon, as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, thy King cometh, sitting on an ass's colt. These things understood not his disciples at the first, but when Jesus was glorified, then remembered they that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things unto him. Now what John is saying, they did not know that the prophecy was being fulfilled at the time, but when they looked back on it, they recognized the fulfillment of prophecy. The multitude, therefore, that was with him when he called Lazarus out of the dead and raised him from the dead, would bear witness. For this cause also the multitude went in and met him, for they heard that he had done this sign. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, Behold how ye prevail nothing. Lo, the world is gone after him. They were losing their hold on the numbers. and this they could not afford to do. Now there were certain Greeks among these that were at the feast to worship, as they came up to worship at the feast. These therefore came to Philip, who was of Bethsaida of the Galilee, and asked him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus. Philip cometh and telleth Andrew, and Andrew cometh, and Philip, and they tell Jesus. And Jesus answered and saying to them, The hour is come. My hour is not yet. The hour is come. Would to God that we could all move in that kind of an order of life. This is the hour. This is the time. The hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a grain of wheat fall into the earth and die, it abideth by itself alone. But if it die, it beareth much fruit. He that loveth his life loseth it. And he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me. And where I am, there shall also my servant be. Now, it's interesting that as far as this verse is concerned, it uses two different words. He that loveth his life loseth it. That's psuche, his soul. And he that hateth his soul in this world shall keep it unto zoe, eternal life. It appears that in that changed world, there ceases to be the concept based around psuche into a concept of life, even as the life of God has. There's two different words that are used there. Now, he says, if any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be, a promise. If any man serve me, him will the Father honor. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause came I unto this hour. Father, glorify thy name. There's a contrast there. Now is my soul troubled. My psuche. My earthly self. Save me, Father, from this hour. The response of the human. What? I came into the world for this hour. Father, glorify thy name. What a difference. A difference of approach, a difference of attitude. Self? How does self respond? Save me from this hour. But when we realize that God has a plan, glorify thy name. This experience alone would change our lives. This experience alone would change our experience one with another, our fellowship. What are we here for? Self? Or are we here for God's glory? There's a difference, isn't it? There came, therefore, a voice out of heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. Father was glorifying his name. I will glorify him, glorify it again. Again. We do not know what we're doing for God unless we're willing to put our plans in his hands or take it from his hands, his plan for us. This is the whole issue. This is the constant picture in John as you study the gospel. My hour had not yet come. The hour has come now when he knew all things were come about. The whole aspect of the gospel of John and the life of Christ is building and unfolding a plan. And Jesus walking in that plan. He's left us an example that we should do as he has done. That we should follow the example he set. Oh, that we just somehow look over the failures of our life and say, Lord, I've tried to run my life so much the way I wanted to run it. Now, Father, your will be done. Your will be done. It'll be a changed picture. And when the Father said this, some thought that it thundered. And I don't know whether people were disturbed with thunder, or some are disturbed with thunder today, but they heard it, and they didn't like it. And some others said, no, that wasn't thunder, that was an angel speaking to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice hath not come for my sake, but for your sakes. Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out, and I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto myself. If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto myself. What's that?
It says all eyes shall see him when he returns.
Now just a minute here. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me after I come down off the cross. The drawing power of Christ is the Christ on the cross. Mm-hmm. He's come off. True. But it's the dying Lamb on the cross that's the drawing power. And you know how that's perverted today? In the crucifix. Mm-hmm. The crucifix is a perversion of that concept.
They've made the cross what they worship instead of Christ.
All right. The drawing is what he did for us on the cross. Now from that point, he moves into another point. And that's at the front. That's at the presence of God, at the throne of mercy. These things need to be understood. And the men would understand him. Didn't the Jews say, if you come down off the cross, we'll believe you?
Yes.
Get off the cross and we'll take you. But don't take you, we will not take you on the cross. And every one of us here would find it far easier to do what we wanted, to live the way we wanted to, if he'd say, okay, you can follow me, and you won't have to take up your cross, and I'll get you to heaven. No. No way. The cross stands between us and heaven. But isn't the words of the hymn about, what's the words of that hymn? If the way of the cross I miss, what? It's the whole thing. And I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. Beg pardon?
The prince of this world is cast out, Revelation 12, 7 and 9.
Yeah, in other words, so that now is the prince of this world cast out. All right, this is Revelation 12. In other words, the prophetic aspect of that thing.
The fulfillment of what that was prophesied later.
All right. And this helps you better understand what Revelation 12 is talking about in the conflict of the dragon and when salvation comes.
Right.
And when the enemy is cast out. It's not talking about the casting out of heaven.
No.
It's the result of the salvation obtained by Christ and casting him out. This helps us better understand that prophecy. Now, he says this in signifying what manner he was to die. The multitude therefore answered him, we have heard out of the law that Christ abideth forever. And how sayest thou the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? Perversion again. Jesus therefore said, in yet a little while is the light among you. Walk ye, and while you have light, the darkness not overtake you. And he that walketh in the darkness knoweth not whither he goeth. While you have the light, believe on the light, that ye may become sons of light. All right. If you are in light and understand that light is shining upon your pathway, then you better do it as soon as that light shines. You put it off, what's going to happen? The light's going to move on and you're going to walk in darkness. Walk in the light as one as soon as you have the light. These things spake Jesus and departed and hid himself from him and so forth and so on. Now, all right, we come now to the 41st verse. After quoting several verses from Isaiah, John comes into this point here. These things said Isaiah, because he saw his glory, and he spake of him. Nevertheless, even of the rulers many believed on him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they love the glory that is of men more than the glory that is of God. Same old principle. They love the glory of man more than the glory of God. You know, this is a sad picture. The sad part about the picture, I mean, the sadder part about the picture is how it's present tense. I've had friends in the ministry, and I could name some of them. Some of them you may know. And I've talked to them. And I've talked to them very straight. They said, Brother Grothier, or they call me William, or Grothier, they said, just as soon as we retire.
I heard that from a conference officer.
Just as soon as I retire, I will speak up. I haven't heard a peep yet.
They're in even worse bondage in retirement than they are as working through
that fight.
Many so. You see, the thing is, this is the strangest thing about this picture. Sadly, I don't know whether they're hiding behind this false concept or not, that if they speak up, they're going to lose their sustentation. This is not true. The American law so preserves them that they can't, the church cannot withhold that retirement from them if they wanted to, thanks to Elder Andreessen.
Well, this is true of the laity in the church, too.
Well, possibly yes.
Well, sure it is. They want to leave.
They want to what?
They don't want to leave.
Well, yes, but I mean, here's the thing. They have this money behind them.
Well, quite possibly, they feel more pressure from their colleagues that are retiring in sync with them than they do about losing the money, because it's a very difficult thing to go up against your brother. And, you know, human nature doesn't like to be different. So therefore, you have to be a very decided person to do this. And the sad part to me is, if they would say to you, when I retire, well, if they really believed it, they wouldn't wait till they retired. They'd do something about it now.
Well, it isn't the fact that they didn't believe it. Theoretically, they believe it.
But that's not believing it.
Well, that's true in a sense. All right?
Here's the point. So many of the laity in the church is all tied with the leaders. But the leaders, is that what the laity leads to?
What's your question?
They're so tied to the leadership.
Oh, laity's tied to leadership. That's true.
If the leadership leaves, would the laity leave?
Yes.
You think so?
If the whole leadership left.
If they're following the leaders, they would.
Yeah.
And some they're caught in a bind. They're afraid they're going to offend somebody.
Well, that's true.
It always comes to my mind that for the biggest majority, new members come in. Dick was one. He had a Sabbath job, a very good paying Sabbath job. You're to give up your job to follow the Lord, but they can't do the same thing. They can't do the same thing. Or they come up with, it's all right to work on the Sabbath, you know, because of the certain job that you're in and stuff like that. How is it any different than anybody else who comes in and has a Sabbath working job and they're told that, yes, they should give them up because it's the Sabbath?
Okay. All right, I see what you're doing. You're giving me response from the viewpoint of the laity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What I am trying to do here is to catch the response based on this verse where it says, because many of the rulers, even of the rulers, believed, but because of the Pharisees, they should be cast out of the synagogue, they would not move because they loved the, and you're emphasizing this, they loved the glory that is of men more than the glory that is of God.
That comes down to a matter of their sustenance. It comes down to a matter of glory. What they're put in as far as their position. They love that more.
Yes, but look at here. All right, that's great. You're correct there. I'm not questioning what you're saying, because, I mean, this is what happens to many of the laymen as far as the decision is concerned. But let me tell you some experiences involving leadership. I'm thinking of a man right now that worked with me in evangelism. I went into his district. He was a district pastor. He absolutely worked with the program of evangelism faithfully, loyally. In other words, there was no division in the evangelistic team. There was no conflict the whole time I was in evangelism with him and another pastor in a dual district in the lower part of Indiana. And I've talked to him on various occasions. In fact, he has been here on the campus. Yes, this is right, brother. This is right. And when I retire, my sustentation is secured, then I will do something. You know what he's doing today? Instead of staying in Indiana where he first stayed, he sold out up there and he's down in Florida playing golf. This is it. He still tries to stay on the list, but he's still down there, huh?
I think you kind of missed my point. If the laity believe that the leadership is apostatized,
yeah.
And what happens when those leaders leave? God's throwing him out.
Well, they claim that the God did the throwing out.
Well, that's what they'll say. Throw him out.
Well, they'll say to throw him out, or will they say that God threw him out?
They'll say that God, they're saying that the day's coming when God is going to purge the church.
Oh, purge the church. Okay.
He's going to put out all these apostatized leaders.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this thing is talking about not that particular point.
No, no. But I hope you understand what
I'm saying. And really, right here, what you have, although in our time, I really do believe that the primary problem right here in our time is material wealth or sustenance from a material, you know, viewpoint. However, Sister Frances did point out something that is no doubt another factor even in our time, and seems to be the factor right here, the primary factor, and that's peer pressure. The peer pressure. What will others think?
That is true. All right, let me give you another illustration.
I want their praise.
You know? Let me give you another illustration. This other minister that I'm thinking about, we worked together as an evangelistic team. He was 10 years my senior, but we worked together. He did not have a brother. I never had a brother. But our relationship was such that we became literally more than just brothers of the faith. We felt a brotherhood just as brothers, two brothers together. We were close. We could work together. We thought in various ways. And we've been close. All right, over the years, and after I made my decisions and I approached him, he wasn't quite ready. He would do something once he retired. But what he said for me to do, and his son, who became a very successful individual, and I baptized the son during evangelism with him, approached me. And they said, I will put up the money for you to go out and do big evangelistic meetings if you'll just come back in line. We'll put up the money for you. I said to him, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Well,
I know that, but I mean, they're coming into line meant back into the thing and bringing all, they said, look at all these people that you can bring into the truth. But this brother now is in a place that he is incapable of functioning normally. He's ill. And so his wife, which was also a close with my wife, and it was a good close bond relationship, said he's not going to be able to use his library anymore. You want to come down here and go through it, and you can have everything you want out of his library. They didn't say, now we're going to put the library at Andrews, they're going to put the library out at La Sierra, they're going to put Loma Linda or Keene or anywhere else. You can have it. They know. Somehow they know, but this is not, they cannot make this an appeasement with God as far as the library is concerned. No way. And I've also been approached by that son. Will you come and take my father's funeral when he dies? Yes, I will. In a situation I can. But I'm sure going to make the most of it. As far as the thing is concerned. And it's going to be very interesting. For here a retired minister having the funeral service by an independent. But that's neither here nor there. I'll take it.
Kind of to get off of that, back to verse 41, where it says, these things Isaiah said because he saw his glory and spake of him. Whose glory does John say that Isaiah saw?
These things said I because he saw his glory. This is referring to the sixth chapter.
But whose glory did
John is John is making it the glory of Christ or what Christ was going to be and so forth.
Okay, so in other words, John says that Isaiah seen Christ's glory.
And he spake of him.
And when did he speak of him? When he saw his glory, right?
Yeah.
Okay, in connection with verse 40, he has blinded their eyes and he hardened their heart, which is found where?
In this gospel.
No, I mean, where in Isaiah is that found?
Well, this is found, well, you don't you have a little reference there to follow it through?
Yeah, it's in Isaiah 6, isn't it?
Right.
Right.
Well, then you go through, that's the right.
When we go to Isaiah 6, though, whose glory does it say in Isaiah 6 that Isaiah saw?
All right, what you're pointing out, a point is the equality between the two as far as God's concerned.
Well, doesn't it say in Isaiah 6 that Isaiah saw the glory of Jehovah?
Right. I'm not questioning that.
And doesn't John say that Isaiah saw Christ's glory when he seen that glory?
Right. Correct.
Well, is Christ and Jehovah? Is Christ Jehovah God?
Well, I think in the Old Testament you'd have to so conclude.
Well, if they weren't, they could still have the same glory.
Right, that's true. All right, let's slip that just a little bit on the thing. Now we come down here to the latter part of this chapter. And it says here, Jesus cried and said, He that believeth on me believeth not on me, but him that sent me. And he that beholdeth me beholdeth him that sent me. Again, you see, they're putting themselves together in oneness. You see Christ, you see the Father. And if any man hear my sayings and keep them, I judge him not. For I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my sayings hath one that judgeth him. The word that I spake, the same shall judge him in the last day. For I spake not from myself, but from the Father that sent me. And now notice, and he hath given me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. I know that his commandment is life eternal. The things therefore which I speak, even as the Father has said unto me, so I speak. Knowing that the commandment of the Father is life eternal, he did it. This is what we must know. It's not a matter of works. It's a matter of life eternal, and we walk therein. Now in the 13th chapter, you have the institution of the... All right.
I'm sorry, but can you explain verse 47?
47? And if a man hear my sayings and keep them not, I judge him not. For I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. In light of the fact that all judgment is committed in his hands? Is that the question?
It's explained in the light of verse 48.
He that rejected me and receiveth not my sayings hath one that judgeth him. The word that I spake, the same shall judge him in the last day.
So he doesn't judge until he's already judged.
Well, sure, he spoke the word makes the judgment. I think in the Old Testament you find it that way.
And also Lord does the same thing.
Well, let's face the fact, as we get into some very critical areas, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 tells us that the Father stepped aside when the controversy began and abdicated in favor of the Son, and the Son himself took over in the struggle of the ages. And so in reality, God is there, and the Son is the active aspect of Jehovah.
But, you know, and John's trying to get that point across because he's basically saying that that when Isaiah saw the vision in Isaiah 6, that glory of God, because it even says in Isaiah 6, then I said, woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, Jehovah of hosts.
Okay.
That's who he saw. John says that Isaiah, the glory that Isaiah saw right there was the glory of Christ.
Okay. All right. But you see, Jehovah the King, when the Father abdicated and Christ took there, who would he be? The King.
Yeah, right. But the point is that this is a direct contradiction to any individual who comes along and says the term Yahweh
applies only to the Father. Mm-hmm. All right. But you see, the thing is, it says there in the Shema of Israel that Hear, O Israel, thy God, Jehovah is one. Mm-hmm. Jehovah is one, but that's Ikkad. And is used in relationship, and the two shall be one flesh of Genesis 2, or the evening and the morning, day one. All right, you see, you have that. Jehovah, in this instance, is two. All right, now we do not need to go into the 13th chapter as far as the circumstances are concerned. We're going to be taking part in communion on Sabbath afternoon, and this will be a part of it. But what is interesting here is this is brought into John's gospel that's not found in the other gospels. And he does not come into or bring out emphatically what's in the other three gospels in the matter of the bread and the wine. He is emphasizing that which had been omitted and left out. But now what I want you to do is to come on over, and we're going to skip a couple of the chapters and come to the 14th chapter. And there in the 16th verse, 16th verse. And I'm doing this not only for the fact of us here, but also for those who will be listening ultimately to tapes that will be ordered, because this is an important factor. He says there in the 16th verse, "And I will pray the Father, and he shall give you another Comforter, that he may abide with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, for it beholdeth him not, neither knoweth him, but ye know him, for he abideth with you and shall be in you. I will not leave you desolate," or as it says in the margin, "orphans. I come unto you." I come unto you. But I'm going to send another Comforter. Now the point is, and I've gone over this before at other times with various ones of the group here, and also in a group meeting, I'm sure, up in Nora Springs. That word, another, alas. I shall give, and he shall give you another Comforter, alas. All right. There are two words in the Greek language that can be translated another or other. Heteros and alas. Alas means one who is distinct from but equal to. Heteros means distinct from but unequal. Jesus did not say that when he prayed the Father and give you another Comforter, that he would give you a heteros Comforter. Both words would say distinct from. He's talking about two different distinct beings. But he's not saying that the Holy Spirit, when it comes, is a heteros, inferior to. He's saying it is alas, equal to. Now this is basic in understanding the Holy Spirit's relationship with the Godhead and the relationship of Jesus Christ. See, the Gospel of John started out as we studied it, in the beginning was the Logos, or in beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and God, and as God was, so the Logos was. Two beings. Now the Logos became flesh. And we've been studying him. Now John's saying, I'm going to introduce another aspect. There's going to come a Comforter, another, distinct from but equal to. He starts out with the two. Now at this point, as Christ is about to be glorified, that the Spirit might come, he introduces the third. There is absolutely no question that the New Testament does present a tritheistic concept of God, not a Catholic Trinity concept. And you've got to make that distinction. Neither do you deny that which was preexistent before Bethlehem. I want to say this and say this again. The great divide for time and eternity was the incarnation. And you have to relate all things in the scripture in relationship to that divide. Before Bethlehem and after Bethlehem. It's no accident that our time is B.C. and A.D. No accident. All of our religious concepts must be B.C. and A.D. And if we would just recognize this importance and the significance of the Great Divide, most of the problems involving the controversy today over the Godhead would be solved. And I'm going to repeat again the fact that as far as the present controversy is concerned, they're not beginning at the right place. There's no reason for me to begin with paganism to find out about God. The pantheistic concept, the triads of paganism, that doesn't help me find out about God. I don't have to start with the Catholic doctrine of the Trinity to find out about God. I don't need that. I need to start where God tells me to start, when there was a great transition and the Spirit of God came upon Mary, and that holy being that was born of her was going to be called, not was, but was going to be called the Son of God. And from that point, you can relate the whole thing pretty well. Now, it's true that you may have to adopt and be willing to accept certain things that's recognized in various Greek commentaries of the Scripture as to what the relationship between Christ and the Holy Spirit is. And as you, many of you know, I use the expression alter ego. Christ and the Holy Spirit are alter egos. Now, some of you, maybe not some of you, some other individuals, questioned me very severely on such an adept and adoption. But I found that I was in good company. I found the balance of this final study of the seminar is found on side B of preface.